Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Brother Robert Johnson. This is episode 159. In the news, I just want to say thanks to everybody who came out to the Children's Dyslexia Center, and a very special thanks to Brother Joseph James, who flew out and came to the Valley of Chicago, hung out, watched the film with us, and even had a Q&A session with us. So again, to everyone, thank you so very much for helping us spread that event around and raising some money for the Children's Dyslexia Center of Metropolitan Chicago. If you want to know more about the Dyslexia Center, please visit www.cdcchicago.com and please support Brother James by picking up a copy of the film The Freemason by going to www.thefreemasonmovie.com. So September is pretty big for events in my area. September 6th, my lodge is being represented at the Waukegan Air Show. The 10th is a table lodge in Libertyville Lodge in Libertyville. And the 13th is a symposium at the Valley of Chicago put on by the Philoladies and the Masonic Society. So if any of that stuff is in your area and you're interested, please check it out. The annual Palladium Symposium will be happening in April of 2015. It's a little ways away, but I wanted to give you guys a heads up because it is going to sell out quickly. Some information on it is that, of course, I will be there and I will be speaking this year along with a bunch of others. Some information about the event. The cost to attend is $40, and there are only 100 seats. This is a Master Mason only event. Only Master Masons whose Grand Lodges are recognized by the Conference of Grand Masters of North America or the Prince Hall Conference of Grand Masters of North America will be admitted. Please have your dues card to present. Todd Creason, Oscar Aline, myself, Antoine Lilly, James Morgan, Sean Gourley, and keynote speaker Rush Losser. All Masonic academics, all great presenters, all in one place, April 18th, 2015. So the schedule is a light breakfast available from 8 a.m. At 8:45 a.m., the symposium opens. Each speaker is going to have 30 to 40 minute presentations, taking questions upon completion. There will be 5 minute intermissions between each speaker. At noon, lunch will be provided. At 1 p.m., speakers resume presentations in the same format until about 3 p.m. At 3:30, the festive board, complete with souvenir toasting glasses, with the keynote speaker Russell Schlosser, ensues. So the evening before the symposium on Friday, April 17th at 7 p.m., there's going to be a gathering for the speakers, and it's going to be held at Club Lucky, a premier family-style Italian restaurant and martini lounge located in Chicago, Illinois. There's going to be a private room being made available for all the Masons and their guests, courtesy of the 5th Northeast District Deputy Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Illinois, Right Worshipful Brother Thomas Kleiner. Dinner expenses will be the responsibility of each guest's. Reservations for the pre-symposium gathering are to be made to Brother Charles Harper, who is the event coordinator, at charpersr@yahoo.com, and they would appreciate if you RSVP by April 16th. So again, for $40, you get lunch, dinner, toasting glass, and a whole lot of education. I think it's going to be a really awesome day. The paper for this week is by the guest that we had last week, Michael Karpovage. If you missed the interview, I'd urge you to go back and check that out. But without any further delays, I'm going to read his paper called Betrayed by a Mason. But there's a question mark there, so we'll read it. Betrayed by a Mason? All right. Here we go. By Michael Karpovage, author of Crown of Serpents, The Tragic Mission of Lieutenant Thomas Boyd. Moments before deploying on the longest military campaign of the Revolutionary War, Freemason Thomas Boyd was given a final ultimatum by his repeatedly spurned and pregnant lover. In front of his superior officers, she warned Boyd, a lieutenant with Morgan's Rifle Corps in the Continental Army, quote, "If you go off without marrying me, I hope and pray to the great God of heaven that you will be tortured and cut to pieces by the savages," end quote. An embarrassed Boyd, his pride tarnished, responded by drawing his sword and threatening to stab her unless she removed herself. She obliged. Unfortunately for the young lieutenant, he should have heeded her ominous prediction, for that was exactly the fate that befell him. Thomas Boyd's death was one of the most heinous acts of torture and murder recorded during the Revolutionary War. Did it really occur because of the curse of a scorned lover? If you believe that centuries-old quote, "Heaven has no rage like love to a haggard turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned," then you might believe there was divine retribution against Boyd. But historical evidence direct from battlefield participants tells a different story. Boyd's death was not the result of a spurned lover's curse, rather it was a classic example of Masonic brothers pitted against each other on opposite sides of battle. Their beliefs, duties, and loyalties were put to the ultimate test to uphold Freemasonry's most sacred tenet, relief of a distressed brother. For upon Boyd's capture at the end of his life, ill-fated final mission, he made the ultimate gesture of a Freemason when he feared for his life. He asked a highly unlikely enemy Freemason for protection, and surprisingly, he received it. However, his relief was short-lived when another enemy Freemason stepped into the picture. Soon thereafter, Boyd experienced exceedingly brutal acts of torture and finally death. And herein lies the question. Was Thomas Boyd, along with the most sacred tenet of Freemasonry, deliberately betrayed by a fellow Mason whose loyalties to a king meant more than saving the life of a brother? The mission. In the summer of 1779, Major General John Sullivan marched his 5,000 Continentals into the Finger Lakes region of New York. Known as Sullivan's Expedition, it was ordered by General George Washington as an invasion into Iroquois Confederacy lands in retaliation for several brutal massacres by British Rangers and Indian warriors. This enemy force had conducted a terror campaign against American frontier settlements supporting the fledgling rebel army. Washington wanted all enemy villages and crops destroyed, a scorched earth policy to disrupt the Troyes and their Indian allies' ability to wage war. Sullivan had, for the last 2 months, executed his orders to the fullest by destroying over 40 villages and soundly defeating his enemy at the Battle of Newton on the New York-Pennsylvania border. His foes had since retreated back into their wilderness lands, leading Sullivan's troops, acting as his eyes and ears were the famous scouts of Morgan's Rifles. Thomas Boyd led a company of these marksmen and pushed miles ahead of the main army on the heels of their fleeting army, sometimes entering villages where corn still boiled in a kettle. On September 12th, 1779, the army marched toward the Seneca Indian stronghold of Genesee Castle, also known as Little Beard's Town, after the Seneca chief who lived there. It was their last campaign objective. Upon reaching Consensus Lake, the army halted and encamped because of a destroyed bridge over the marshy area. Across that bridge, and leading west up a forested ravine-filled bluff, ran several Indian trails to the objective. But the correct path remained unclear to Sullivan because of inaccurate maps and unreliable intelligence. A nighttime reconnaissance mission to locate the proper trail was ordered. Sullivan knew the scout leader Boyd was a man of daring disposition and summoned him to his tent. He gave Boyd specific orders to select 4 of his most trustworthy scouts to locate the correct path to the objective, make no enemy contact, and report back before daylight. Although described as reliable, courageous, and honorable, Boyd was also reckless, cocky, and overconfident. On this assignment, his latter character traits resulted in a series of deadly mistakes. Instead of taking the specified 4 men, Boyd defied direct orders and took 26 men and 2 Oneida Indian guides, hardly the stealthy unit called for. This fateful decision led to the deaths of most of the men in his party. On the opposite side of the battle, positioned in the area Boyd was about to penetrate, was Colonel John Butler, a Tory and the leader of Butler's Rangers. Butler was a Freemason. His unit was based out of Fort Niagara with an area of operations that included the western New York and the Pennsylvania wilderness. His son, Walter, was a captain with the Rangers and was notorious for his inhuman acts on battlefield victims. Allied with the Rangers were Brandt's Volunteers, a contingent of Iroquois warriors and white Tory frontiersmen led by Chief Joseph Brandt, a Mohawk Indian and captain of the British Army. He was also the first Native American on record to become a Freemason. Prior to their defeat at Newtown, the Rangers and Indians were undeniably the fiercest combination of guerrilla fighters in the Revolutionary War, but Brandt often did not get along with Butler due to the barbarous acts at the hands of the younger Walter. Although they distrusted each other and vied for power, they worked for a common cause, to kill rebel soldiers and civilians who supported independence from King George III's colonies. During their reign of terror, these guerrillas murdered, dismembered, scalped, and kidnapped many American settlers. They slew livestock and burned down villages, yet the leaders blamed each other for the atrocious acts of the troops under their command. They became infamous figures, despised by the Americans, each earning a price on his head. It wasn't until the massacres at Wyoming Valley in Pennsylvania and Cherry Valley in New York that George Washington finally issued orders for an all-out campaign to destroy this continued threat. In his orders to Sullivan, Washington directed him to, quote, to lay waste all the settlements around, that the country may not be merely overrun, but but destroyed," end quote. Boyd's party of 29 scouts set out on the path west toward Genesee Castle on the early morning hours of September 13. At the same time, Butler and Brandt had planned an ambush on the same bluff above Sullivan's army. When the engineers had fixed the bridge and the Continental troops proceeded up, they would pounce. After cresting the bluff, the trail split, and fate took over. In the darkness, Boyd's men actually passed the Rangers and Indians on a parallel trail traveling in the opposite direction, neither knowing of the other's presence. 6 miles behind enemy lines, still in darkness, Boyd's party discovered a recently deserted Indian village, with fires still burning inside the huts. Fatigued from the long night march, they hunkered down for the night. When daylight broke, Boyd and his two best sharpshooters, the famous Indian fighter Timothy Murphy along with James Elliott, snuck close to the village and observed two Indians approaching. One Indian was on horseback, the other led a cow. Murphy and Elliott fired simultaneously. Murphy killed the walking Indian, an old Tuscarora. The other, though seriously wounded, escaped. Murphy then ran up on his victim and took his 33rd scalp. It is not known if Boyd ordered his men to shoot. Regardless, contact with the enemy was made under his leadership. It would be his second fatal mistake. Realizing his position was compromised, he sent two runners back to report the location of the village, the killing of the Indian, and the return of his detachment. As the scouting party retraced their path back east, and just 2 miles from the safety of the main army, Han Yost, one of the experienced Oneida Indian guides, found a different trail leading off to the southeast. He urged Boyd to take this route instead of their original one, north toward the ravine, but Boyd disregarded his advice. Their party then discovered 5 enemy Indians retreating from them in plain sight. Yost knew this was a ruse to invite pursuit and urged Boyd not to follow for fear of ambush. Again, Boyd overruled his guide, the third fatal error. The party gave chase and Murphy caught up and fired a ball in the trailing Indian's back. He then coolly pulled another scalp and stole his victim's leggings, which were of good scarlet colored cloth. The chase continued. The Indians successfully lured Boyd's party closer to their main force, laying in wait for ambush not a mile up from the repaired bridge. Among the British forces, Butler heard the approaching firing on his right flank and thought his ambush had been discovered. He shifted his men and, to his surprise, found a rebel detachment running toward him. Before he was aware of it, Boyd blindly led his own men into the embrace of 500 Rangers and Iroquois warriors. He was surrounded. Boyd's party took cover in a small grove on a knoll with clear field of fire. He realized his only chance of escape was to compact his force and strike in mass at a given point to cut the enemy line. The first volley downed many of the enemy without the loss of a single scout, but the enemy ranks closed. After the second volley and return fire, the scouts started dropping. Hand-to-hand combat ensued. The firing was so close that the black powder of the enemy's muskets was driven into their flesh. With the majority of his men now dead and Boyd injured with a shot through his side, he ordered a final charge. Murphy led the rush and tumbled a larger Indian warrior who blocked his path before several of the scouts beat their way through and ran for their lives. 2 Indians pursued Murphy. He eventually outran them, but not before pausing to cut off his earlier stolen leggings, which proved too small and hampered his flight. Again set upon by another bloodthirsty warrior, Murphy put a ball through his breast, killing him instantly before finally reaching the safety of the main camp and raising the alarm. 2 other scouts hid under a log in the tall grass back on the knoll and went unnoticed before also making their way back to the main army. Boyd tried to follow through the breach, but his wound hindered his escape. He and 2 other men, Sergeant Michael Parker and their guide Yost, were taken prisoner. Yost's own Indian brother, who fought with Brandt, recognized him, and a confrontation ensued. Chief Littlebeard stepped up and slammed a tomahawk into Yost's skull. He was then hacked to pieces by the vengeful Indians for being a traitor. It was at this moment that Boyd asked for an audience with Brandt, whom he knew to be a Freemason. In a last desperate attempt to save himself from death, the Rangers and Indians ripped scalps off of Boyd's fallen men, picked up their wounded and dead, and started a hasty retreat back to Genesee Castle. Boyd found himself in the clutches of his enemy and fearing for his life. The sign. Continental Army First Sergeant John Salmon, a friend and fellow soldier in Boyd's company, described the incident. Quote, "When Lieutenant Boyd found himself a prisoner, he solicited an interview with Brandt, whom he well knew commanded the Indians. This chief, who was at that moment near immediately presented himself when Lieutenant Boyd by one of those appeals which are known only by those who have been initiated and instructed in certain mysteries and which never fail to bring succor to a quote-unquote distressed brother, addressed him as the only resource from which he could expect a respite from cruel punishment or death. The appeal was recognized, and Brandt immediately and in the strongest language assured him that his life should be spared. End quote. This account was confirmed by Brandt's adopted nephew and close confidant, British Major John Norton, in his 1816 journal, when he wrote, quote, "Captain Brandt used every endeavor to save Captain Boyd." End quote. Salmon's well-documented letter, one of the main sources of Boyd's Masonic appeal, appeared in the appendix of Life of Mary Jameson, The White Woman, a best-selling memoir originally printed in 1824. It was said, but not proven, that Salmon was one of the scouts who escaped the ambush, but there was no evidence to suggest he was an actual witness to this important exchange. Rather, he may have simply passed the story along. However, Mary Jameson, who was kidnapped at the age of 15 and raised by the Seneca Indians, was living at Little Beard's town at the time. She knew the butlers, Brandt, and many of the rangers and Indian warriors. She was 36 years old when this incident occurred and did witness the tortured deaths of Boyd and Parker. Her account corroborates Salmon's letter. Boyd's gamble that Brandt would uphold the sacred tenet of the fraternity was well-founded. Brandt was known as a worthy brother Mason who kept his word through his actions. Raised and educated in Tory schools, Brandt was a man of many qualities, attributes, civilized, intelligent, charismatic, and a persuasive English orator. He was also a brave and a brutal war chief, a battlefield leader of men, and loyal to the British cause. He was considered the epitome of the noble savage, and had even visited London, where he was received as the Indian King. On April 26, 1776, Brandt was initiated into the fraternity of Hiram Cliftonian Lodge No. 417 in Leicester Fields, London. He had the distinct honor of having his Masonic apron presented to him from the hand of King George III himself. Brandt's legend of upholding the Masonic honor on the battlefield came from an earlier incident following the Battle of the Cedars in late May of 1776. He was alleged to have saved a rebel Mason from execution after the surrender of American troops. Captain John McKinstry, wounded and facing burning at the stake, recalled that Brandt was a Freemason and gave the Masonic sign of a brother in distress. Brandt accepted the sign and secured McKinstry's release and resulting fair treatment. After the war, they remained good friends. Brandt was even honored at McKinstry's Hudson Lodge No. 13 in Hudson, New York. Members of McKinstry's family vouched for this story during author William Stone's research for his biography, Life of Joseph Brandt's Theandangia. However, there is one major fallacy to this account. Joseph Brandt was clearly in England at that time. In fact, he was about to set sail from Falmouth on the merchant Lord Hyde. He arrived back to British-held Staten Island in New York on July 29, 1776. Another possible explanation was that the saving of McKinstry did not occur at the Cedars in Canada, but instead at the Battle of Oriskany in New York on August 6, 1777, where Brandt was definitely present on the scene. Two more stories were attributed to Brandt saving his rebel prisoners before death. One story came directly from Lieutenant Jonathan Maynard. On May 30th, 1778, he was captured by Brandt's Mohawks and said that Brandt recognized a Masonic tattoo on his arm and interceded. The other story revolved around Captain John Wood on July 22nd, 1779. He was the sole survivor of 40 dead after an engagement between Brandt's Indians and American militia on the Delaware River. After being taken prisoner, he supposedly gave the Masonic hail sign, and Brandt personally intervened and saved him as well. However, after finding later that Wood was in fact not a Mason, Brandt treated him with contempt. Years later, Wood's son said that his father had inadvertently given the signal. In both cases, Brandt sent the prisoners of war to Canada, where they were held for several months and then exchanged for British prisoners. One of the first acts that Wood did upon his return was to become a Freemason. Torture, death. Boyd and Parker were escorted back to Genesee Castle, where the rest of the rangers and Indians had retreated after Sullivan's forces responded to Boyd's surprise ambush. Inexplicably, their protector Brandt disappeared from the scene. Salmon described what happened next. After their arrival at Beard's Town, Brandt their generous preserver, being called on service which required a few hours absence, left them in the care of British Colonel Butler of the Rangers, who, as soon as Brant had left them, commenced an interrogation to obtain from the prisoners a statement of the number, situation, and intentions of the army under General Sullivan, and threatened them, in case they hesitated or prevaricated in their answers, to deliver them up immediately to be massacred by the Indians, who, in Brant's absence, and with the encouragement of their more savage commander Butler, were ready to commit the greatest cruelties. Relying probably on the promise which Brant had made them, and which he undoubtedly meant to fulfill, they refused to give Butler the desired information. Butler hastened to put his threat into execution. They were delivered to some of the most ferocious enemies, who, after having put them to a very severe torture, killed them by severing their heads from their bodies. In the recollection of eyewitnesses Mary Jemison, 80 years old, during the interviews for her memoir, she described the torture of Boyd, Little Beard, in this as in all other scenes of cruelty that happened at his town, was master of ceremonies and principal actor. Poor Boyd was stripped of his clothing and then tied to a sapling, where the Indians menaced his life by throwing their tomahawks at the tree directly over his head, brandishing their scalping knives around him in the most frightful manner, and accompanying their ceremonies with terrific shouts of joy. Having punished him sufficiently in this way, they made a small opening in his abdomen, took out an intestine which they tied to the sapling, and then unbound him from the tree and drove him round it, till he had drawn out the whole of his intestines. He was then beheaded, his head was stuck upon a pole, and his body left on the ground unburied. Thus ended the life of the poor Thomas Boyd, who, it was said, had every appearance of a being of an active, enterprising officer of the first talents. The other was, if I remember distinctly, only beheaded and left near Boyd. Another account described the torture in even greater detail. The prisoners were seized, stripped, and bound to trees and severely whipped with prickly ash boles. The Indians commenced a series of horrid cruelties directly, especially toward Thomas. When all was ready, Little Beard lifted his hatchet stained with the recent blood, and with steady aim sent it whistling through the air, and in an instant it quivered within a hair's thickness of Thomas's head. The younger Indians were now permitted to follow the chief's example, and from right, front, and left, their bright tomahawks cleaved the air and trembled above the unflinching persons of the victims. Wearied at length of this work, a single blow severed Parker's head from his body and mercifully ended his misery. Poor Thomas, however, was reserved for a worse fate. An incision was made in his abdomen, and a severed intestine was fastened to the tree. He was then scourged with prickly ash balls and compelled to move around until the pain was so great that he could go no farther. Again, pinioned, his mouth was enlarged with a knife, his nails dug out, his tongue cut away, his ears severed from his head, his nose hewn off and thrust into his mouth, his eyes dug out and the flesh cut from his shoulder, and then sinking in death after their enormities, he was decapitated, and his disfigured head, after being partly skinned, raised by the frenzied savages upon a sharpened pole, and a knife stuck into the body where it was found. The betrayal. Was this atrocity the result of a deliberate act of betrayal? There is substantial evidence to suggest that Boyd was not the resolute patriot he was portrayed to be, but instead broke under interrogation after being threatened with death. According to this letter, excerpt from Butler to the Commandant of Fort Niagara, Lieutenant Colonel Mason Bolton, on the day after the killings, Butler specifically reported, quote, "I found that a scout of the rebels, 30 in number, had fallen in with the right of our line, and 22 of them had been killed by the Rangers and Indians in that quarter. A lieutenant who commanded the party and a private were taken. The officer, who is a very intelligent person, says that the army consists of nearly 5,000 Continental troops, 1,500 of which are riflemen, commanded by General Sullivan, and Brigadiers Hand, Poor, and Clinton. They have but a month's provisions, and intend, according to his account, to come no further than Genesee. They have 4 pieces of cannon, the largest a 6-pounder, a cohorn, or a mortar, and a howitzer. They are building a strong fort at Tioga, and men to keep a large garrison there." Butler clearly stated that Boyd gave him the intelligence which refuted Salmon's account. So why then, if Butler gained this crucial intelligence, would he still turn Boyd over to the Indians? Some historians suggested that, in the absence of Brant, he was forced to hand the captives over. It is possible he could not control the Indians, who were intent on revenge. However, if that were the case, it begs the question, why didn't the Indians allow Boyd and Parker to leave the ambush alive? Another theory claimed the Indians wanted revenge on Boyd specifically for the unnecessary and cruel killing of the old Tuscarora by Murphy in the deserted village. Yet the Indians themselves killed men, women, and children by the same means. They stalked them unseen, put a bullet or knife in their back, and then scalped them to show how brave they were. No historical evidence backs up this claim. However, the evidence clearly shows that Butler knew of Boyd's Masonic protection by the following justification. He said that any Masonic obligation were overruled by the duty of an army officer to serve his king and must not be invoked to protect rebels. This was in direct defiance of the sworn obligation of a Freemason to never deprive a fellow brother of his life or property regardless of the state loyalties. The savage, quote-unquote, Brandt comprehended and embraced that tenet. Butler did not. He never played by the rules. He saw only one loyalty, and that was to the British monarchy. He and his son Walter had never confirmed nor denied responsibility of Boyd and Parker's deaths. According to Isabel Thompson, Kelsey's biography, Joseph Brandt, Man of Two Worlds, quote, Butler said nothing then or later. The two Butlers, father and son, never wanted to talk about atrocities they had seen, end quote. In his 1901 book, The Mohawk Valley, author W. Max Reed issued a scathing indictment of Butler and his son. When their acts are compared with those of Joseph Brandt, their deeds are the deeds of savages, and Brandt's the acts of a noble, generous man. The Butlers appear to have been not only arrogant and supercilious in a high degree, but barbarous, treacherous, revengeful, ferocious, merciless, brutal, diabolically wicked, and cruel. With the spirit of fiends, they committed cruelties worthy of the dungeons of the Inquisition. No wonder their lives are not attractive to historians. Butler made another exculpatory statement. He claimed that after the examination, Boyd was escorted to Niagara, but as he passed through Genesee, quote, an old Indian rushed out and tomahawked him. Why fabricate this story when many individuals witnessed and participated in the actual torture killing? Was this a way to cover the betrayal he committed? The Continental soldiers who found the bodies the next day wrote of the many marks of torture inflicted, but none remarked on a single tomahawk wound. A direct contradiction to Butler's claim that one Indian tomahawked Boyd came a year later from the mouth of the Indian who said he'd led that party that captured Boyd. In George Beck's Wyoming, written in 1858, this condensed version asserts, on the 27th of March, 1780, a party of Indians captured Libas Hammond Thomas Bennett with his son Andrew, a lad of 13 or 14 years of age, in the Wyoming Valley of Pennsylvania. The lead Indian said he led the party that took Thomas Boyd up near the Genesee River, and he further said, quote, Boyd, brave man, as good a soldier as ever fought against the red man. He said that they tortured Boyd, cut off his fingers and toes, plucked out his eyes, etc. Still brave, Boyd neither asked for mercy nor uttered a complaint. Ah, brave Boyd knew very well the character of the Indians. He then brought out a sword and said, there, Boyd's sword. Hammond examined the sword and discovered the initials of Thomas Boyd's name stamped on the blade near the hilt. That night, Hammond, Bennett, and his son rose up on their captors, killed 5 of 7 of them as they slept, and made their flight safely back to Wyoming Valley. The sword was brought away by Libas Hammond and was afterward presented to Lieutenant Boyd's brother, Colonel John Boyd. Whatever way this tragedy is viewed, whether it was a woman's curse or Boyd's fatal mistakes, the historical evidence showed that Butler was the key person ultimately responsible for sentencing Boyd to death by the Indians. Ironically, the one person who tried to save Boyd's life was an Indian. The day after this tragedy, the Continentals entered Genesee Castle. There, as dogs gnawed at the remains, they found the mutilated bodies of Boyd and Parker. They were given a ceremony and buried on the bank of Beard's Creek, under a copse of wild plum trees. Sullivan gave orders to burn everything in sight. Over 120 houses and several hundred acres of crops were razed. The long, arduous campaign was over. It forever broke the back of the once mighty Iroquois Confederacy. Thomas Boyd's remains and the bodies of his fallen men were disinterred and transported to Rochester, New York in 1841, where they were reburied with honor on Patriots Hill in Mount Hope Cemetery. And again, this is copyright by Michael Karpovaj, 2010, the author of Crown of Serpents, Map of Thieves, and Flashpoint Quebec. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to support the show. The first way you can support the show, again, is through the apps. We have an application for the Windows 8 platform, Apple, or Android. These are, of course, for your mobile devices. The benefits of these apps are the fact that you will get to, you can actually stream them, you can download them, you can mark your favorites. The main two benefits are, of course, that the papers we read on the show are available to you via PDF form, including this week's. You'll get Michael Karpovaj's paper in with the application. You'll also get wallpapers for your mobile device. So at this point, there's 159 episodes, so there are about 159 different wallpapers and PDF documents for you guys. And the app costs $2. Two other ways you can support the show are, of course, by direct PayPal donation. And those PayPal donations go right into the show and help us host the audio files and pay for equipment when needed. And with PayPal, you pick the amount, either $1, $5, whatever you want, it's up to you. There's no set amounts. And the third way is through shopping. So there are two places to do some shopping. One is onnit.com, who offers some really nice healthy living supplements and workout equipment. You can go to onnit.com and at checkout, type in your promo code WCY. That will give you 10% off of your entire order, as well as a little piece of the sale comes back to this show. So you're helping out that way. And the other is with freemasonryart.com. So anything you like on freemasonryart.com, it's the best artwork you're going to find. It's done by Brother Juan Sepulveda of the Winding Stairs podcast and the Masonic Roundtable. You're going to love his stuff. If you use the promo code WCY, you're going to get 10% off of your order. And again, a little piece comes back to this show to help out. Next is this week's famous Freemason. This week, it's Brother Sean Benjamin, who is unique in the fact that he's one of the few famous Freemasons that is still alive and kicking today. In fact, he's doing a little bit more than that. Brother Sean Benjamin is a performer and entertainer, and he's got a couple albums out. He performs in the pop and R&B, acoustic folk, blues, rock, swing, alternative styles. He crosses a lot of boundaries with his music. It's said that his shows are unpredictable. He hates the idea of being cornered into a single genre, so he even has a band called Lucky City in his band of musicians. He mixes rockabilly and blues and alternative rock with even hip-hop, reggae, and soul music. He travels all around the United States performing, and you can check out on the web at www.seanbenjamin.com. That's SEANBENJAMIN.com. That's it for this week. Please remember to find us on Facebook, follow on Twitter at WhenceKMU. You can check us out on Google Plus at the email address WCYpodcast@gmail.com. Please check out the Midnight Freemasons blog at www.midnightfreemasons.org for 3 new articles every single week. If you like that, then consider checking out the subscription to the Working Tools magazine. More info on the subscriptions can be found at twtmag.com. The Masonic Roundtable. It's like The View, but always Masonic. All the guests are Masons, all of the hosts are Masons, and the topic is always Masonic. We go live on Tuesdays at 10, 9 Central. Our last episode was about military lodges. It was fantastic. We're syndicated on video on youtube.com/themasonicroundtable. We're also on iTunes. If you'd like more information on the Masonic Roundtable, please visit themasonicroundtable.com. Check out Fraternal Ties for some great Masonic neckwear, and Brother John Paul Gomez just released a really nice watch made of teak. It's a wood. It's a great, awesome looking watch. It's full of symbology. I went ahead and got one myself. Let me know if you guys get one too on the Facebook page. Just drop me a line. We can talk about the cool watch. Remember, the work continues on the new show, The Masonic Radio Theater, and I'd like to play a little audio sample for you right now before we end the episode.
The Masonic Radio Theater is on the air. Welcome to Masonic Radio Theater, brought to you by the Midnight Freemasons. Tonight's episode is The Craftsman.
That's it, guys. Stay on the level, and until next week, for WhenceKMU, I'm Robert Johnson.